My little board has written up here. There are three different people written. There's Jonathan, Elijah, and John. John, the Baptist, I didn't write the word the Baptist on there. You get the idea. Three individuals who I want to talk about who are Elijah types. I say that types because the stuff that happened in those individuals' lives, God then used again in the following Elijah. So stuff that Jonathan does here, God uses again in Elijah and John the Baptist. The stuff that Elijah does, God uses again in the form of John the Baptist. He regurgitates the acts and the events that happen in these men's lives. So it's important that they're written here not for just for, oh yeah, there was some guy named Jonathan who he was the son of Saul. So what? No, it's not that simple. God's using these individuals to show us a picture of what the kind of person we're looking for is. Because all of you are aware, we're still observing and watching, looking for the Messiah to come. Well, we know he gets predated by at least two witnesses, right? Who are the two witnesses? Elijah's one of them, and Moses is supposed to be the second one. Those are two, it's the type of person. I'm not saying Moses will be resurrected from the grave, we've discussed that. No, we're nothing of that sort. We're talking about the spirit of Elijah, the spirit of Moses, is in the next two witnesses. One who shows you the law and to follow the laws of God, and one who shows the Messiah and to follow the Messiah. Two witnesses that do the same thing. In Jonathan's case, he starts out this process. Yes, you could argue there are many Elijahs prior to Jonathan, but they're less detailed. As far as Moses and Aaron and how those two worked together, yes, there was an Elijah type, a preparer type, that helped set the stage for the deliverer to show up. But in this particular case, I want to cover all of those. It would take, I'd have to recover the entire Torah, and that's just beyond the scope of what I want to discuss today. What do we know about Jonathan right now? What do you recall about it? What did he do in the first book of Samuel? Say it again. True blue. He's a very honest, very believable and admirable character.
Courageous.
Very brave. Started the war with the Philistines. Yeah. With just he and his servant. Yes, Ellie?
Selfless. He helped. He's the son of the king, but he helped his partner David to become.
Yes, he does. He sacrifices his own ability to become king in order for David to be that position.
He kept the covenant with David. They just made this covenant and he keeps it.
You're right. They actually make a number of covenants. This is the first one. And he keeps it. He keeps his part of the covenant no matter what. To his own detriment. Again, selfless individual. There's a few characteristics or personality traits that Jonathan has that I want to talk about today. As we've written here, it's a Jonathan with the semi-equal sign of, similar to Elijah. I have written down that helps king, it's obviously abbreviated, helps a king lead godly people in spite of the Philistines. That's his physical events that occur in his life. Whether the king is Saul or whether David doesn't make a difference, he helps the king lead godly people in spite of the adversary or bad things that are happening about them. That's good. That's a good trait to have. And that's the type of trait that Jonathan is showing here. But that trait shows up in much more detail as you go from next Elijah to next Elijah to next Elijah. It goes in more detail, more depth, deeper inside the individual people that are being involved. So Jonathan starts out as hit by his first time we really meet him, he attacks and kills a Philistine governor. Provokes a war. Did he do it by command? No. What would make him go forth and say, all right, my father's just been anointed king. We have this Philistine governor here that rules over us, taxes us, does various things to us. What would make him say, okay, I'm going to go kill him? God didn't tell him to do it. Saul didn't tell him to do it. No one told Jonathan to go forth and kill this governor. He took it of his own accord and said, I know that God's on our side. Prophets can do that. I mean, how many of us can honestly say at any moment in time, oh, God already agrees with me? I mean, honestly, I've tried that once. I got into a car accident shortly thereafter. He corrected me on that one. God does not agree with me. Either I agree with him or I don't agree with him. He doesn't agree with me. But in Jonathan's case, he said, oh, God's on our side. He already agrees with me. He goes forth and does it. That's what Elijah does. That's what John the Baptist does. not an ordinary individual. Jonathan's not an ordinary individual. So he goes forth, he kills this governor. I forgot which chapter it's in. I forgot the man's name. Or I don't know if he rattled off his name or not. It doesn't make a difference. Provokes a war with the Philistines. Of course, all the Philistine army comes forth. Oh, let's go kill and destroy all the Israelites. Jonathan, of course, he's confined with his father, and they have 600 men left of the Israelites. It's stuck in Gilgal, waiting and waiting for Samuel to show up. Jonathan leaves with one man with him, his armor bearer. And he goes forth, hey, come with me. Let's not tell anybody. We're just going to go. So two of them walk around. They leave the camp, leave the 600 men, I think it's about 600 men, left behind them, left their father behind, didn't tell anybody they were going. They walk around the hills, walk around the edges. Oh, hey, look. There's an outpost of Philistines there, a little squad, you can use that term. I believe there are 20 men, I think it's 20 men, in that squad. He looks up at them, says, looks to his armor bearer, says, hey, let's walk over there. If they tell us, come up, God's going to kill every one of them by our hand. If they say, stay there, this was not God's will. Almost sounds like someone's forcing the hand of God, doesn't it? Well, yeah. Yes.
The Lord had spoken to him, and it's just not recorded.
We're getting there. Because Jonathan is a type of prophet. Yeah, he doesn't go forth and say, the Lord, thus says the Lord. Nothing of the sort of that. No, not that kind. But that God speaks through him is undeniable. He does that. So, and Jonathan is going forth and says, oh, well, these are the two events that will happen. And, of course, what happens? The man looked down, hey, the Israelites come out. Come on up here. Philistines, 20 men versus 2. Obviously, the two are pathetic. They're not going to do anything to this. Jonathan says, oh, no worries, let's go. Goes on up there, slaughters all 20 of them. Just two men by themselves. That one event then takes all the rest of the 600 men of Israel. They see, hey, look. Something bad is going on in the Philistine camp. God's doing something. What is this? And he, by that one event, inspired the rest of the men to go forth and destroy and wipe out the Philistine army. That's a prophet. Elijah did that, not via a sword, but of similar nature. John the Baptist did it in a different type of way. We're going to discuss how these men did these same type of events. Jonathan's goal here, however, was not to create a godly individual. I want to point that out. That's very important because these are distinctions between Jonathan, Elijah, and John the Baptist. It's who they were dealing with and who their objective was. Jonathan's objective was to help a king, help a leader, to lead God's godly people. Elijah's job was not, by the way, in spite of what was going on, that you had the Philistines that were coming to attack, don't worry, godly people, God's still with you, we have a good leader now, now we're going to go forth and do something that is right, to help fulfill God's word. In Elijah's case, he did the exact same thing, but in this case, in Elijah, when he shows up, he's not dealing with the Philistines. He's dealing with other people, other nations. But his big problem are the kings. Elijah had a different scenario going on. Jonathan's goal was to create a godly nation. Elijah's goal was to create a godly people. John the Baptist's goal was to create a godly person. God scaled down from the big picture idea as each one of the Elijahs showed up. When he first showed up with Moses and Aaron, he was building the godliest nation you could ever have imagined. Well, that degraded quite a bit, if you recall, by the time the kings showed up. At the time the kings were showing up, God's goal was not to create a godliest nation, was to create a godly people with inside that nation, which requires a godly leader, hence David, hence Saul when he first showed up. These men are beginning to starting out that way. God's goal at this point in time in Jonathan's history was not to create like Moses and Aaron, but to get it a little bit more focused, a little bit narrower down. Forget the whole idea of this wonderful, perfect theocracy, because this talk didn't happen, it didn't work. Now we're going to scale it down to, all right, there are good people with inside this theocracy we're going to focus on. Yes, Sharon?
I was just going to say, I thought that was always his goal,
to make godly people?
Not expressed yet. God's ultimate goal has always been that fashion, but his methodology of showing that to us is how we know that. For example, if you lived back during the time of Jonathan, would you know anything that happened with Elijah? Of course not. Elijah's not even born yet. You wouldn't know any of the remaining information at all. All you have is the information up to this point. Well, when Jonathan shows up, this process which he goes through directs and points the people and says, oh, God is giving us more information. Oh, we're trying to find a godly leader, one that is holy, that can lead his holy people with inside this nation to do what is right. When Elijah shows up, it points out that the people say, okay, wait a minute, we don't have a godly leader. We're not going to get a godly leader. This is quite obvious. But the priesthood was still godly. So when Elijah showed up, hey, paraphrasing here, people, forget the leader, forget the king. Focus on the priesthood. They'll guide you to follow God. Well, the time John the Baptist showed up, what happened to the priesthood? They were about as corrupt as the kings were. At that point in time, God is giving more information to people. All right, people, individuals, forget the kings, forget the priests. Focus on me, just one person at a time. These are these Elijahs do. That's their objective. To gather the people to set it together as a unit to follow God, it just narrowed down from a theocracy to a nation, to a people, to an individual. Yes, Susan.
It could be termed remnant theology.
I'm not familiar with that term.
It's a remnant. It always comes down to the small group that God always has. And you see it. You see it in that. It goes from one down to the other and down to the other. And then really the individual. And those individuals make up the remnants.
Which actually is very consistent with what God did with all the other, with the remnant, if we call the beard that gets cut, part of man's beard gets burned, or part gets cut by the sword, or scattered by the wind. There's always a little bit, a tiny bit left that God works with, which is consistent with what God seems to be functioning, how it works. So I want you to recall that and remember that, because if we go through Elijah's story and we get in the king section, this is going to come up again. There are a number of events that happened in Elijah's time, because John the Baptist was called a warrior for God for a reason. What did he do? Well, he fought on God's behalf, just like Jonathan did. He fought on God's behalf, just like Elijah did. These men are regurgitating themselves, God's reusing their information, reusing their lives, to help guide the people to one objective, which was to him, to guide to him, to guide to God. In Jonathan's case, being Elijah, since there's always Elijah predates Messiah, that's his standard philosophy on almost every religion there is when it comes to the Bible. What happened? Who followed Jonathan? Who did the people find? David. David's who they found. Was David a godly leader? Well, you better believe it was. Did he pass every test God gave him? Not even close. But he still was a godly leader. When Elijah showed up, who followed Elijah? Elisha. Was Elisha greater than Elijah? Yes, by every measure. Was David greater than Jonathan? Yes, by every measure. Who followed John the Baptist? Yeshua. Was he greater than John the Baptist? Yes, by every measure. Each of these individuals are Elijahs. They predate the one that's supposed to follow and point everybody to him. The forerunner, yes. So, as I mentioned before, when I use these equating terms, Jonathan is Elijah, I'm not talking about reincarnation, as Holly said. It's God reusing individual information. When David, I say David is the Messiah. I'm not talking about Yeshua, the Son of God. No. He is a type of Messiah that God is using to write information down that will happen with the Messiah. Why did the Messiah be born from Bethlehem? Because David was born from Bethlehem. If David was born out of Ephraim, would Messiah be born from Ephraim? You better believe he would be. If David was born in Egypt, would Messiah be born in Egypt? You better believe he'd be. He'd have to be, because David was the pre-Messiah. He was the first precursor. He is the one we say, oh, thank you, God, for our Messiah map, known as David. Now let's find out which person comes along that fits the map, fits the criteria listed. Well, Messiah fit it. Because God wrote it down based on who David was, a man after God's own heart.
Just looking at you, I'm looking at the pattern that you have going here, and help the king in spite of the Philistines, help the priests in spite of the kings, and now you got to help the people in spite of the priests. So I was just wondering, in the end, with the remnants, with the little flock that's left over, where the spirit of Elijah will help the little flock in spite of the people.
That's actually a very profound statement. I won't say you're right or wrong, but I think that's a good point. As you notice, look around you. How many people of God, Rahm Emanuel is a good example, are not? The vast majority. They are not. The people of God are not God. They're not of God. You have to do it in spite of them. That's a wonderful way of putting it. Now, by the way, the ultimate objective when all these Elijahs and the final Messiah comes to pass, he takes over his kingdom, what's it going to accomplish? The same thing that God started. The ideal theocracy. The ideal monarchy that God is king. And all the nation, it's a complete whole theocracy of all people like Moses and Aaron to follow God, but only in the inspiration and desire to follow God. Not because their law says to, because their heart desires it. Yes, sure.
So are you saying, for every Messiah type, was there an Elijah?
So far that I've seen, yes.
Who's the Elijah?
Elijah for Joseph? Judah. Maybe. Number of things that Judah did. There's a number of things he did. Number one, he saved Joseph's skin. Saved his life by selling him instead of allowing his brothers to kill him. Judah then separated himself out from all amongst his brothers. After that event, that changed Judah, who he was. That changed where he said, all right, family, I'm not like you. I have to set myself in such that I am going to lead in new direction. And he did. Now, there's a reason why God and Jacob says, of course, he's at the time of his deathbed, I think it was, that the scepter, the kingly line will follow through Judah. You are the one who set the stage. How did Joseph get to Egypt? By the one who prepared the way. Judah. Judah set him up so he could go to Egypt. All the other brothers didn't. Not even Reuben. Reuben didn't set up to go to Egypt. Reuben set up to be saved, which failed miserably, because Reuben slept with somebody he shouldn't have. But Judah didn't. Now, in Judah's case, when he divided himself out and separated himself out, what did he do with Tamar? He had three sons. The first two died. He did the whole process. Tamar gets knocked up by Judah, and it's a whole weird system going on there. We're not going to discuss all the details, but that set the stage for a deliverer to be needed. Because with Judah's scenario, with he produced two twins from this one, from Tamar, the king line went through one of them, but not the other line. Zerah's line was separate. Perez, oh, thank you, Perez, because the name's right. That's where the king line went through. So David comes from, not Zerah's line. But that set the stage for something. It set the stage for God to create a preparer, not only in the land of Israel, but in the whole world, because of where Zerah's line went, who didn't have the kingly line of Israel, but the kingly line of most of the other nations around them. God set that stage. Those nations today, of course, are all Christian. Most are all Christian, with one exception. But God, by setting the stage up so that someone like Joseph could come along and deliver those people out, that's how it worked out. God had set Judah and Joseph up in that fashion. Yes, Ellie.
Judah even redeems himself in it, because when he goes down, With Benjamin, he tells his father, you take my two sons, they're yours if I do not return your son. So he got a second chance and leaves his two sons as collateral. So, and then he goes in and is reunited with Joseph. So Judah didn't do it right the first time, but he got it right the second time.
He eventually gets it right. So yeah, there are other examples as well with Moses and Aaron. It's obvious; those are too simple. There's obviously the prayer and the deliverer. But you have in Abraham's story, they're a prayer and a deliverer in there as well. Granted, they're a little bit overlap, but they're still a prepare and deliverer. Who prepared Abraham to be who he was? His father. His father left. His father left the people, left the land of Ur. Said, we have to leave. This is not where God is. God is directing us somewhere else. He set the stage for God to say, all right, Abraham, now that the riffraff is now gone, now you and I are going to talk. Now you're going to be brought in to deliver your descendants into my own nation. There's a continual duality here that God uses. He wants us to remember that and notice when that happens. He repeats it over and over and over again for our goal, our benefit. Okay, I'm going to get past this now, so I don't want to go through too much in this because it'll take, like I said, this is a much more detailed discussion is needed here, but I don't have time to do all of that because I'm supposed to be in 1 Samuel. Excuse me. As I mentioned before, I'm trying to do a recap of this chapter before I move on to 2 Samuel. Because in 2 Samuel, we have a lot more details of what David is and how he is a Messiah to us, as well as to his people at the time. So chapter 18 was to discuss how Jonathan and David meet and how, of course, they continue on their relationship in as a form of covenants and work together to produce a godly leader, to produce a deliverer for the people of Israel. Well, chapter 19, of course, as we know immediately happened in 18, is that Saul wants David dead. It doesn't take more than a day or two from the death of Goliath for Saul to say, okay, this obviously this man is a detriment to me. So David, of course, accuses the leadership. I'll use that term very specifically, of not fearing or following God. See, David, by accusing Saul of saying, hey, Saul's trying to kill me, what's he saying? If I go with it and I declare openly and says, the President of the United States has a price on my head, and I can demonstrate it, what does that mean? Corruption, I'm talking about treason, a man being thrown in prison who's a leader of our country. That's not a lightweight argument. It's not a minor thing to accuse someone of. So when David comes forth to Jonathan and says, our leader, meaning Saul, the king, is not fearing or following God because he wants me dead. I've done nothing to offend him. No offense has been given to me. What is Jonathan's reaction? Oh, that can't be. My father would never do such a thing. That won't happen. No. You can't. That's impossible. Well, of course, Jonathan finds out, no, David was right. The Messiah accused the leadership of doing something pretty rotten, too. You recall our Messiah when he showed up on the scene? What he accused the leadership of doing? Den of thieves, I think it was. He's actually accusing the people, the leadership, of corrupting and doing something ungodly and not following God. Just as David has accused Saul of doing the same thing. There's no difference here. They're the same type of person. Saul, of course, makes an attempt on chapter 20, attempt on David and Jonathan's life at the new moon celebration, which Saul demonstrates, the leader demonstrates his blinding hatred of this one who's going to usurp his authority. Sound familiar? Well, yeah, it sounds familiar. It should sound familiar to all of us. The Messiah is accused the same thing. Blinding hatred of the man. Though they can prove nothing against him, they still have blinding hatred of him in order to kill because he can usurp all of their authority. They're fearing. Hasn't done it yet, meaning at the time, but he could. Saul knows David hasn't usurped his authority yet, but he fears him because he knows he could. David, of course, has to flee. He goes to Amalek, the Nob. You recall the town of Nob that Saul, of course, wipes out of the entire town of priests, the high priest included, Ahimelech, if you recall. David eats the showbread and takes the sword and he tells high priest, "Oh no, no, I'm doing God's work." He actually uses a slightly different phrase. My father sent me. That sounds familiar. David used the term father-in-law, but yeah, close enough. Minor details. Father-in-law, father, similar. Sounds familiar. It should sound familiar to us. Because David is a type of Messiah, just like Jonathan was a type of Elijah. These people are symbolic of each other. We're supposed to be observing and saying, oh, okay, this tells us what our Messiah is supposed to look like. So our Messiah should run across a similar phrase. Comes the priests of God, comes the people who follow God and say, my father has sent me. Did the Messiah do that? Well, he did to everybody. He told everybody he was sent by his father. Nothing my father doesn't allow me to do. I know nothing except his authority. What did the godly people in David's time suffer? For every one of them who believed and allowed David to pass through unharmed, they were all killed. That sounds familiar too. Those who believe in the Messiah, guess what happened? Persecuted for it. To the death. Accused by the leadership, Saul, or in this case, Sanhedrin from Messiah's time, of following this usurper, this man who claims he's king. Both instances. Sound familiar? It should sound familiar. This is a Messiah. We're supposed to be observing him. Continues on. Saul orders these executions, by the way, without trial. Sound familiar too? Yeah, that does sound familiar. Murdering, executing the people who followed David, or in this case, assisted him, or executing people who followed Messiah without trial. Just ordered their deaths. And of course, it was carried out. In chapter 23, David, who had to flee, he gets a unique scenario dumped upon him. He gets not only king, he gets an ephod, the ear of God. David becomes this odd mix of both a king and a sort of priest. Because he can talk to God and ask him any question he wants, and God will answer him. Sound familiar? It should. David goes, and in this verse, chapter 23, he goes and delivers a group of people of Israel out of a certain death. They were being surrounded with Philistines. He goes and he saves them, delivers them out, and what do? They turn him over to the leadership to be killed. Sound familiar? Yeah, it should. In chapter 24, David is tested. He's tested in a fashion, in my mind, is similar to Messiah's test, but you may disagree. That's perfectly okay. In chapter 24, David cuts a corner out of Saul's garment. I love that chapter because it's so important to who the Messiah is and how Saul recognizes, I know you're going to be king. You know, that sinking feeling like, ugh, I was wrong. You hate that feeling. Everybody hates that feeling. I was wrong all along. Well, that's the feeling that Saul gets at this, but that moment in time. So David, of course, 24, David's tested to kill Saul. If he kills Saul, would he then be king? Most likely, yeah, Saul's men may not follow him, but then again, when Saul dies eventually, Saul's men still don't follow David. That doesn't matter. So that wouldn't have changed the outcome. But he could have become king at that moment in time. What did he opt to do instead? He left it up to God. To me, that is a test of pride of life. That's my personal opinion. That is a moment when you can say, I can have all the power that God wants me to have. And be right. You could totally. You could talk yourself into it. David's men wanted it. They tried talking him into it. This is clearly what God wants. But it wasn't. God was testing him. Are you going to do this, or are you going to let me do this?
Kind of similar to the temptation of the Messiah. It's exactly the same what happened to Yeshua. God's power or your own?
Precisely, which is why I wanted to cover it. Because it is identical to it. They're being tested the same way. In the following chapter, what happens? Well, the following chapter is the story of Nabal. If you recall him, David gets upset because he doesn't share any of his flock. He's going to go kill Nabal for being a jerk, essentially. In that story, Abigail comes and saves Nabal and tells David, "This is not right. You do not avenge yourself on Nabal. Let God do it." She argued many, many, many things regarding Nabal. Why is this not worth it? Oh, he's just a base person, blah, blah, blah. There's only one thing he focused on when David heard. "Ah, do not avenge my flesh upon him." What is that to you? To me, that's lust of the flesh test. My flesh by desire. Not power. He wasn't going to gain any power. It's not like a pride of life like killing Saul. This was his personal desire of vengeance. And did David pass? Yes, he did. God tested him. Well, yeah, he'd help. Hey, he's still flesh and blood. I'll give him credit. There's this separation between Messiah and David. He's not quite equal. Yes, he did. He did. He gave credit that God had sent her out forth to him to advise him otherwise. So he passed the test of the flesh. Messiah was tested that way as well. Not with, you know, killing somebody out of hatred, but still tested. Now, of course, chapter 26, David gets tested again, the pride of life. Saul is there amongst his camp, all, not by himself, but all laid out, sprawled out with his generals on one side and other people on that side. He has his nephew with him. His nephew said, "You know, David, if you're not going to kill Saul, I'll do it. I won't miss. One strike's all I take. He's right here. They're all completely asleep, a sleep that only God could have put on them because they're talking. Only God could have put this type of sleep on him." So his nephew's saying, "Obviously God set this up for you. Take it." What did David do? He took a canteen, a spear, to demonstrate he was there, but left. Did he pass the test? Yeah, he did. He didn't take it upon himself to take that power, which he could have easily done. Now, the lust of the eyes, we already know David failed. Those of you who recall, which we haven't read there in 2 Samuel, but Bathsheba, when he sees this wonderfully attractive lady, guess what happens? Does he pass that test? Not even close. Failed it by leaps and bounds in many ways. So was he in fact the Messiah? No. He was a type of Messiah. He is not the one and only. He is the one which we say, "Oh, okay, there are good things that this person has done. These good thing template we must focus upon and look at. That's our template to use when we see a good thing Messiah show up." In fact, I actually will finish 1 Samuel today. Chapter 27, of course, David flees. We've already read through each of these chapters individually and discussed them in great length. Chapter 27, David flees again to Gath. And of course, he works with the Philistines and demonstrates. Well, actually, I like this statement. This is actually quite interesting to me. At least I find it fascinating. Because David's own leadership and people rejected him, where did he go? To the other people who wouldn't reject him. Sound familiar? You know, Messiah's own people. Yeah, guess what? He went to his own. His own didn't receive him. What did he do? Where did he go? He went to those who would receive him. The Philistines or the Gentiles or the Greeks. David did the same thing. His own people wanted to turn him over to Saul. They did not desire him. They didn't want him as their king. So he had to flee. He left to the Philistines, who did receive him with open arms, quite happily. Because they actually stated, "Clearly Saul wants you dead. You must not like your people anymore. You obviously came to us." Obviously, Saul's been trying to kill you for a number of weeks, if not years now. We don't know how much time has actually elapsed, so it's kind of a little vague there. That's when, of course, the leadership of Israel, known as Saul, collapses down into just a, I guess, I don't have a good word for it, debauchery almost, I don't know, I'm not quite sure. You can Saul's a medium, and because God has rejected the leadership. God said, I will no longer speak through you or to you. Sound familiar? Yeah, it kind of does, actually. He, of course, goes to an alternative source. Not a very good one, but still an alternative source. David, in the verse chapter 29, of course, is dismissed. He doesn't have to go fight Saul. And, of course, in chapter 30, shows up. David has to go home, go back to this territory of the Philistines, which he runs across for this three-day cycle, as we discussed when we were covering it back at 30 and 31. It takes him 3 days to travel home, sees when he achieves home, when he expects to find peace and joy and open arms, finds devastation. He goes 3 days travel out from there, where he finds a man who should be dead, and he grants the man life. He goes, within that same day, he finds the Amalek, the people, who should be dead, who expect life, but instead receive death. I like the cycle of three things, very important. Personal preference, of course. We'll discuss more of that next chapter because it comes up again. But he finds out on these three-day cycles, the first one, that the 3 days where Saul and Israel should be alive, Saul and Israel are dead. See, a three-day cycle in God's cycle, as I look at it, in God's Torah in the Bible throughout, in many, many ways, distinguishes the point which at the end of 3 days, you either live or you die. Some of you live, some of you die, depends on what the scenario happens to be. Well, in the Messiah's case, 3 days, both died and lived. Funny, huh? He had three men with him. One died permanently. Sorry, two men with him. One died permanently and two lived. He was one of them. There's still a cycle of three. Part of you at the end of three, this day of testing, when you were distinguishing between will you live or die, part of you will die. But part of you will live too, as long as you're following God. I happen to like the story, the cycle of the three, because David, Messiah uses it a number of times, and the Bible uses it a number of times as well. And to me, that cycle of three parallels the destruction of the authority of the leadership at the same time which Messiah becomes king or is raised up. That's just one of the reasons why I happen to like it. In 31, the final chapter of 1 Samuel, Saul, of course, is now dead by this point in time. David is now God's anointed king, though here's the main distinction, which we're going to get in 2 Samuel. Much like our anointed king who isn't here yet, David doesn't just get the kingdom, does he? He has to go forth with his 600 men, slowly build converts, slowly build up his army, slowly build up the tribes to support him, and take it by force. Say it again.
Judah first and the rest of Israel.
Very true. Much like our second Messiah is supposed to the same thing. He's not going to be granted, oh, poof, we're all perfect and wonderful, you're now king. Nothing of the sort. He has to fight for it. Yeah, he's the anointed king, but it's not just given to him on a silver platter, so to speak. He actually has to fight and take the kingdom, much like David now has to do. He has to take the kingdom out of those who currently own it, the other leadership, which takes him a number of years to do, by the way. A number of years to do. It takes him a few years to do. That's my overview of 1 Samuel. I realize it took me forever and a day to cover the overview of something that took me, almost 2 years to cover to start with. I realize that these are not detailed discussions. If you want detailed discussions, those are on our website. You're certainly welcome to go through each individual chapter as we discuss those one at a time. This is more of what I want to make sure we take away with us. You may take away much, much more, but at least take this much with you, because it's going to come up again in subsequent books, in a few chapters from now, actually. Actually, the next chapter, couldn't think of it. Some of it will come up again. I want you to remember that as best you can. You're not going to remember everything, that's okay. But hopefully there's a spark of memory. Oh, yeah, there is a Messiah here. It's in David. Jonathan, of course, now is dead. Elijah's dead. John the Baptist is dead. And the one who followed dies as well, eventually. But he still has to go through the process. He still has to point us to a witness, which is Elijah, someone who points the way, prepares the way for the deliverer. Jonathan prepared us for David. And Elijah prepared us for Elisha. And John the Baptist prepared us for the Messiah himself. And our future Messiah, we're all waiting for, we have to have at least one preparer that's going to show up and say, I'm preparing the way. I'm making straight the paths. You remember this, the quote? I don't even remember the quote, honestly. Make straight the ways of the highways. Prepare you the way. They had to set that stage up. God willing, each one of us will see that Elijah when he shows up. If he isn't here already. Who knows? What was that? Haven't heard anything yet. But preparing the way usually means preparing the people for a deliverer. Like, now is the time we need a deliverer here. Repent. To go follow God. In spite of who the people are. In spite of the enemy. In spite of your leadership. In spite of your godly leadership. In spite of, as Hector pointed out, the people around you. That's who these Elijah men are. Any questions or comments? I'm sure there's probably a few, but I realize it's just an overview.
Why don't we call Elijah a Jonathan type, since Jonathan was the before Elijah?
Same question you could also ask, why do we not call him an Aaron type? Or why do we not call him a Moses type? Why do we not call him an Abraham type? Why do we not call him an Adam and Eve type? It's because what you do is you name, much like how the book of Isaiah is written, you name an event or a type of person after the biggest individual who was there, who did something. So Isaiah, for example, spans 60 or 70 some odd years. Maybe longer than that. It might be longer than that. Actually, yeah, I think it was almost 100 years, I think it spans. Just shy of 100 years. Was Isaiah writing all of those items down for 100 years? No. Well, what happened? What about the last half of the book? Who wrote it? Did Isaiah write it? No, he didn't. His followers wrote it, but they used his name because he was the greatest individual who said anything about the events they were talking about. So, at a time which Elijah shows up, he is the greatest individual and far easier to see than Jonathan is. So we call him Elijah because the spirit of Elijah, the one who prepares the way. Well, God used that terminology many, many times. But the person who is the greatest of them is the one we name it after. Very common. That criminal. What's his name? Ponzi scheme. Was he the greatest? At the time, he was. Today, not even close. Our government thinks it's far superior. But the Ponzi scheme, we still call it Ponzi scheme. Because he was the first who did the biggest thing, wow, of his day. Well, now, was it Madoff? And there's like two or three other guys who out-surpassed them by a long shot. But we call it by the person who did the biggest thing at the time. That's what we name it by. It happens many times, many other ways. Like Lou Gehrig's disease, he was the first person to ever get it. Many people before him, but he was still, we still call it Lou Gehrig's disease.
I was just going to say that John in the New Covenant, I mean, Scripture itself says that he was the Elijah that was to come. So it seems like, even though I see all the similarities with Jonathan and David, that John was as great almost as Elijah was. I mean, the two are almost the same as far as importance.
I have no argument there. I agree with you. I'm not covering John the Baptist today. As far as the many things he did and how he did them is more unique to me than what he did, per se. But his methodology was what I find fascinating. But John the Baptist was by far, in many ways, greater than Elijah. So was Bernie Madoff than Ponzi. But we don't call him Elijah. We actually call him John the Baptist. But we still call it the spirit of Elijah because Elijah was still the first one who did something great. There's always so that God continues to build. And you have to realize that this looks like God's narrowing down. He starts from a big nation to people to individuals. Well, in the process, he's building from a warrior to a prophet to one almost beyond prophetic status. He's building the individuals who are delivering the messages. He's just shrinking the people who are hearing them. Yeah, in many ways, John the Baptist is more than a prophet, to me at least.
Yeshua says, what did you go out into the wilderness to see? A prophet? Yes, I'm more than a prophet.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments? I hope you enjoyed it. Have a wonderful rest of Shabbat.